The days of unleavened bread, they picture putting sin out of our lives. And they're 7 days long, and the reason they're 7 days long is because it pictures putting sin completely out of your lives. But there's another significance to the 7 days. It shows that it's not easy to put sin out. If it were easy, it would only be 1 day. But the fact that it's 7 days shows us that, you know, it takes effort to get that sin completely out of our lives. In fact, it's a struggle to put sin out. And we have to struggle to do it. You've heard the analogy about the best way to get rid of air out of a glass is to fill it with water. And it's the same thing with unrighteousness or sin in our lives. The best way to get sin out is to put righteousness in, because, you know, nature doesn't like a vacuum, and, you know, God doesn't like to see nothingness there. And there's an interesting story in the book of Matthew in regards to this, and I'd like to turn there in Matthew chapter 12. In this regards that you just can't leave things empty. You know, putting sin out is not, that's only step one of a two-step procedure. So if you'd like to turn to Matthew chapter 12. Matthew 12 and verse 43, Christ speaking, he says, "When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places seeking rest and finding none." This is the spirit. "Then he says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when he comes, he finds it empty, swept, and put in order." So there's been nothing there. It's just swept and clean. "Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there, and the last state of the man is worse than the first. So shall it be with this wicked generation." So it shows that it's not good enough just to put sin out. You've got to replace it with righteousness. You've got to have God's righteousness in there. The man did not replace the vacancy left with anything good and righteousness, and his last state as a result was worse than the first. This is a lifelong process, and the key is not to give up if we occasionally fall short. We need not get discouraged, but rather go on our knees and confess our sins, and the blood of Christ will cleanse us of our sins. Thankfully, we can do this on a daily basis, and it's good that we can do it. Today, I want to talk about sin. Now, in order to be able to overcome sin, we must zero in on what it actually is. And there are several biblical definitions of sin, so let's just have a look at them. What is sin? Well, the one scripture we're quite familiar with is in 1 John 3 and verse 4, defining sin. In 1 John 3 and verse 4, it says, "Whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, for sin is lawlessness." And the King James manner, "Whosoever commits sin transgresses the law, for sin is the transgression of the law." There are also other definitions of sin found in the Bible. One is found in Romans chapter 6. So it's more expanded in the Bible as to what sin is. And over in Romans 6, it just further defines it and expands it a bit more. In Romans 6 and verse 13, it says, "And do not present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin, but present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead, as your members, as instruments of righteousness to God." So we can see that unrighteousness is also in the Old Testament. It gives us a definition of righteousness. So we know that if we are unrighteous, that is sin. Well, what is righteousness? Over in Psalms 119, Psalm 119 and verse 164, it says, seven times a day I praise you because of your righteous judgments. So God's judgments are righteous. And a little bit over earlier in Psalms, in Psalm 119 and verse 160, Psalm 119 and verse 160 says, the entirety of your word is truth, and every one of your righteous judgments endures forever. So God's word, the Bible, is truth, thus also righteousness. And in a little further in Psalm, the same chapter, Psalm 119, and this time verse 172, it says, my tongue shall speak of your word, for all your commandments are righteous. So all of God's commandments are righteous. So in other words, breaking any of those judgments or commandments is unrighteousness and sin. Then there's also this definition of sin found in Romans. In the book of Romans, in chapter 14, Romans 14 and verse 23, but he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not do it from faith. For whatever is not from faith is sin. So here, sin is the transgression or breaking of God's law, statutes, and judgments that are still in effect today, such as tithing, for example. It's a sin not to tithe. And how do we know that it's a sin not to tithe? Well, if you go to Malachi, it tells you over in Malachi 3. In Malachi 3, and in verse 8, it says, Malachi 3:8, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? And God answers, in tithes and offerings. So robbing God is stealing from God. Stealing is breaking one of the commandments, and thus a sin. And you can go over to Exodus to determine that, over in Exodus chapter 20, a scripture that we're all familiar with. Exodus 20 says, you shall not steal. Pretty straightforward command from God. Not tithing and giving of offerings is sin. Now, I just want to, I don't want to embarrass my wife, but she wrote an article on tithing, and it, I just want to read it, and if you haven't read it, it doesn't matter. It's not a very long article, but it brings out some interesting points. I want to just touch on these. It says, tithing was a difficult concept to practice at first, especially as we were poor. But, I mean, who wasn't poor when they first came in the church, right? We can't afford to tithe to be in this church. Hearing a family say as they walked away. In other words, our family was telling us that, right? There was a challenge, and at times we would ask ourselves, how in the world can this work out? There were times when our extended families would express concern about our tithing, shaking their heads and saying, "You're giving all your money away," you know, to Mr. Armstrong and to the church. But we held to God's promise that He would take care of us, and we watched at times in amazement how things would turn out in our favor. It always worked out. God helped us in every way. And I mean, you know, like it says, you know, you cannot give God. We learned to trust Him. We learned to be patient, to work hard, and to do things ourselves to improve and to make do and appreciate. And our lives were full and exciting. They were exciting at times when you didn't have enough money to make ends meet and you're wondering how you're going to do it. When our extended families visit us today, they still shake their heads as they look at our many blessings as well as our beautiful big home and property, one that they would wish for themselves, and they cannot understand or figure it out, saying, "How in the world could this have happened? Can I afford to tithe? I can't afford not to. I only wish that all my family understood this." And it is interesting because, you know, over the years, we didn't always have the home we have now, but over the years, God blessed us because we tithed faithfully. And, of course, you know, we have a beautiful home now, and they come over and they sit on the back porch and they look at our yard and they just shake their heads. You know, how did this happen? But it wasn't just an accident. It's because we were faithful in obeying God. And there are benefits of tithing. I mean, you know, God blesses you. But on the other hand, you have to suffer the consequences of doing things foolishly in the area of finances. And I mean, I've gone through those areas. I mean, believe me. I mean, I remember one time it was basically me because I was responsible, dug ourselves into quite a deep financial hole, right? So anyway, I had to go talk to the credit union and try to work this out. And I'm sitting there with the financial officer of the credit union and her assistant in an office, and I'm going through all the details about, you know, the situation I was in financially. And the assistant looks at me and she says, "How can you stand there or sit there so calmly and tell us about this disaster?" And I said to her, I says, "Well, if it makes you feel better, I'll throw myself on the floor and thrash around and have a hairy fit." But I'm just trying to be realistic here. And you know, I was tempted, and I mean, I don't look down on anybody that declares bankruptcy because they got themselves into, you know, financial problems. But I said, I made this mess. I'm going to work my way out. So, you know, I worked part-time, and I mean, you know, the family suffered in the sense that I was gone quite a bit. But I worked my way out, and, you know, God blessed us because we did the right thing. So, I mean, there are definite benefits to tithing. I mean, I can vouch for that. And a person that, you know, doesn't want to tithe or give offerings, he's really putting himself on very, very thin ice. I mean, you know, when you consider what's going to happen in the future, why would God protect you in any way if you're not even prepared to, you know, tithe a command that is so clearly given? Now, what about the origin of sin? Let's go back to the origin of sin, and I want to thank Rob Harris for taking some of my scriptures last Sabbath, but it doesn't matter. We can go over some of these scriptures again. In Isaiah 14, talks about the origin of sin. In Isaiah 14, and beginning in verse 12, it says, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground. How you have weakened the nations, for you have said in your heart, 'I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the furthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will be like the Most High.'" So, I mean, he wasn't going up there with the intent, you know, of having coffee, in a sense, with God. He was going up there to overthrow him. And, in his heart, he wanted to kill God. I mean, you don't have a coup d'etat with the intention of, you know, doing good. But it's interesting here, too, is that he says, exalt my throne above the stars of God. Now, someone who sits on a throne is someone in authority, and we know that Satan is the god of this world. But it's also interesting when you think of this for those that believe in the Trinity, right? I mean, we know that Satan has a throne, right? That's mentioned right here. It's also mentioned in Revelation. And Jesus Christ has a throne. That's mentioned in the Bible too. And God the Father has a throne. But, you know, the poor Holy Spirit doesn't have a throne. He was left out in the cold. I mean, you know, they just don't think about these ideas they have in their minds about, you know, the Godhead. But, I mean, it clearly states here that he has a throne. He had authority over the earth, and he is called the God of this world. And it's further amplified his attitude over in the book of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 28. In Ezekiel 28, it gives us a little bit more of the story of what happened here. Ezekiel 28, verses 12 to 15. It says, "Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre, and say to him, Thus says the Lord God." And of course, what happens here, it switches over to Satan the devil. "You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty." So, here was a being that was spirit in nature. God called it perfect, a perfect creation, and full of beauty and wisdom. So, I mean, how much more does a person want? You know, eternal life, wisdom, and, you know, beauty. Of course, beauty is defined in the eye of the beholder. You were in Eden, the garden of God, so we know he was on earth, where Adam and Eve were. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, the onyx, and the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, sapphire, and it lists these. The workmanship of your timbals and pipes. So it sounds like he was involved in music too. In other words, you know, not only did he have all these jewels, but he was involved in music. Was prepared for you in the day you were created. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God, so he had access to God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created. So there was a perfect creation till iniquity was found in you. And we read on here. It says, "By the abundance of your trading, you became full of violence from within, and you sinned, therefore I cast you as a profane thing." So we know that Satan sinned. He turned. Now, it describes, it was his pride that became a problem, but Christ also said that he was a liar and a murderer from the beginning. And of course, Christ said that because you don't go up and try to overthrow someone with the intent of doing them good. He had evil intent in his heart. But, I mean, it was a process very similar to, you know, that we talk about leaven and sin in that. But, I mean, he just didn't get up one day and say, "I'm going to go overthrow God." I mean, and look at the influence over a third of the angels. Now, that's a huge, you know, percentage loss when you figure, you know, of rebellion. But, I mean, it, first of all, he turned slowly. And we don't know, it doesn't say, I mean, what was the pride. I mean, what was the problem? I mean, he was pride, or was he upset because God's plan was to make humans, you know, a mere mortal, and eventually those mortals would be over him? Was that what got into his craw? I mean, it's possible. I don't know. But he could have been upset about that. But something was bugging him, and it was like a little bit of sin, and he didn't put it out of his mind. He left it there, and it grew. Now, Satan, what did he do in our former association? He didn't have to spend a lot of time there. All they had to do is put a little compromise there, right? And then walk away. And that compromise grew, and the compromise grew and grew and grew. And the next thing you know, I mean, it's just total catastrophe in the church. So something happened to turn him, and he managed to turn a third of the angels to his line of thinking. I mean, that shows you the destructiveness of sin, and that's why it's so important that we put sin out of our lives. Now that we have, you know, looked at it, I've got to bring something else out here, but it's in the main part of the body. So I've got some points now I want to go over in regards to sin and what it does to you, how it reacts with you if you don't deal with it. And the first one I want to cover is sin deceives. And over in Hebrews, it talks about this. Over in Hebrews chapter 3. And we'll read verses 12 and 13 in Hebrews 3. It says, "Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelieving in departing from the living God." And in verse 13, "But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sins." So not only does sin deceive you, it hardens you. It has a dual effect here. You know, there's a saying, if you knew you were deceived, you wouldn't be. The problem is that sin tricks you into thinking that it's okay, there's nothing wrong with me, I'm okay. In other words, it deceives you. Tricks your mind into thinking that sin is suddenly okay. Now, let's go over to 1 Timothy in chapter 2 in regards to this deception. In 1 Timothy 2, and in verse 14, it says, "And Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived, fell into transgression." Now, you got to understand what was going on here. I mean, Eve was deceived, but I mean, Adam and Eve were very naive, right? I mean, they were adults, but they had no experience. I mean, you know, it says, "Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." In other words, they were naive, and they had never dealt with a snake like the Satan, the snake, you know, the good analogy, and he was deceptive and lying. But they weren't exposed to that. So in a sense, you know, she was deceived because there was no history. They only dealt with God, and of course, God can't deceive. God is righteous. God only tells the truth. So let's look at the account in Genesis and read what happened there. I mean, Satan took full advantage of the situation, you might say. In Genesis 3, we'll begin in verse 1, it says, "Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord had made, and he said to the woman, 'Has God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?'" Now we know that this is in reference to Satan the devil, not, you know, a talking snake in that sense. "And the woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God said, you shall not eat, nor shall you touch it, lest you die.'" So it wasn't just a question of eating it. They weren't even to touch it. "Then the serpent said to the woman," first lie ever pronounced, "'you shall not surely die. For God knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Well, wait a minute here, folks. God tells you what's good and evil. You don't suddenly decide for yourself. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it looked pleasant, and the tree desirable to make one wise. So this is what she thought, make one wise. She took the fruit, and she also gave to her husband, and he ate it. I mean, you know, that doesn't say too much about men in a sense, does it? I mean, you know, the woman takes it, and he just goes along with it. I mean, he could have stood up and said, don't touch it, don't do it, don't listen, but he didn't. So, I mean, you know, we can't put all the blame on Eve in this situation, can we? God tells us what is good and what is evil. Once you start determining that you decide what's good and evil, then you, in a sense, become like a God, because that's a God prerogative. So that's what the problem here was, not the fact that, you know, knowing good and evil. God tells us our choice is whether or not to do good or evil. That's our choice. We don't suddenly decide what good and evil is. That's a God prerogative. And that's why it says in verse 22, then God said, behold, the man has become like one of us. Not in the sense that he had all power and authority and creative powers, but in the way that they think and the determination as to what good and what evil is what God is referring to here. So therefore, he had to put him out of the garden lest he live forever. Adam sinned by going along with his wife. Because sins deceive, it's hard, in a sense, to recognize the sin in you. And you know what the end result is when you have a situation where you're deciding what sin is? I was reading this, and it just struck me. It's so clear, the end result of this, and that's found in the book of Judges. When you have a person, a group, a nation that suddenly takes on the determination as to what is good and what is evil, you have the situation that you find in Judges in the last chapter, in chapter 21. And I'm almost there. And in verse 25, this is the end result. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did was what was right in his own eyes. The end result of taking on that God prerogative of determining what is good and what is evil, everybody does right in his own eyes. There is no law. You just do what you want. And look at the condition of the United States and Canada and the nations today. They're doing what is right in their own eyes, redefining, you know, sin, redefining what marriage is. You know, they just turned everything upside down. So that's the end result. And as a result of that, you can see why God has to punish the nation so badly and bring their thinking back around to normal thinking. God tells us what's right and what's wrong. Our job is to figure, or is to obey or not obey, not deciding what is right and what is wrong. My second point is sin corrupts. And I'd like to go over to Genesis 6. So sin deceives, and then it also corrupts. Over in Genesis 6, and verse 12 and 13, actually, Genesis 6 will begin in verse 11. It says, the earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is full of violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them from the earth. So we see the result of the corruption of sin at that time. God had to destroy all of mankind except for eight souls which he saved in the ark. And that was the effect, one of the effects of sin, how it corrupts you. So badly he had to destroy it, not only mankind, but, you know, he saved some of the animals too, just to It's like a fresh start, you know. Get rid of that, and then we start all over again. And over in Deuteronomy 9, talking about this effect of sin being corrupt, or corrupting you, I should say, in Deuteronomy chapter 9, and verse 12, we read, "Then the Lord said to me, 'Arise, go down quickly,'" this is God talking to Moses, "'from here, for your people, whom you brought out of Egypt, have acted corruptly.'" And I get a kick out of this at times, because you have Moses and God, which we know as Christ, right? And when something goes wrong, God says, "Moses, your people..." And then sometimes it's Moses says to God, "God, your people." I mean, they're trying to pass the buck, blame the fault. I mean, it was the people who were having problems, but they couldn't decide as to whose people they were. But in this case, you know, God said, "It's your people whom you brought out of Egypt." But we know that isn't the fact. It was God that brought them out of Egypt, right? "And they have quickly turned aside from which way I have commanded them." So here again, they turned against God's commandments, which is sin. "They have made themselves a molded image. They turned to idolatry," and sin is corrupted them. They were corrupted and turned to idolatry. And also in Deuteronomy 31, and we'll read verses 28 and 29 of Deuteronomy 31. And verse 28, it says, "Gather to me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their hearing, and call heaven and earth as witness against them." And in verse 29, "For I know that after my death they will become utterly corrupt." So he knew that they would go the way of corruption and turn aside from the way which I have commanded you. In other words, they'll start breaking God's commands. "And evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger through the works of your hands." So, here again, you know, sin has a corrupting effect on you. And notice the connection between being deceived and corrupted by sin. And that's found over in Hosea, in the book of Hosea. It gives a link, a connection. No pun intended. In Hosea chapter 9. Hosea 9, and we'll read verses 7 to 9. It says, "The days of punishment have come, the days of recompense have come. Israel knows the prophet is a fool, the spiritual man is insane, because of the greatness of your iniquity and great enmity. The watchman of Ephraim is with God, but the prophet is a fowler snare in all his ways, enmity in the house of God. They are deeply corrupted, as in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity, he will punish their sins." So we see here that they were deeply corrupted. And also in Ephesians 4, in the New Testament, in Ephesians 4, and we'll read verses 20 to 22 here, it says, "But you have so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him as truth, as the truth is in Jesus, that you would put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitfulness of lusts." So here he's admonishing them to put away the old man which is corrupt because of sin and deceitfulness of lust. And the admonition is in verse 23 and 24. and to be renewed in the spirit of your mind. In other words, during the days of unleavened bread, your renewal in the spirit of your mind, your commitment to God, and that you put on the new man, which was crucified according to God in the true righteousness and holiness. And of course, we know all God's commandments are righteous. So he's saying, put on this new man, like he says in Corinthians, a new lump, unleavened lump, that is. Notice God will remember their iniquities and sins which corrupted them. Over in Deuteronomy, and back in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy, in chapter 32, in Deuteronomy chapter 32, and we'll read verses 1 to 5. God speaking here, it says, "Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as raindrops on the tender herb, and as showers on the grass. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. A God of truth and without injustice, righteousness and upright. They have corrupted themselves. They are not his children because of their blemish, a perverse and crooked generation." And you could almost feel the lament in God's voice when he speaks about this, about how they're perverse and crooked. You could feel the lament in his voice, how sad it is that they've gone this direction. The third thing that sin does, sin corrodes. Now, the word corrosion is not found in the Bible, but when you understand how it works, you can grasp the concept. Here is the biblical definition of corrosion. It says, "Corrosive is a substance that has the power to cause irreversible damage or destroy another substance by contact." And they give the example of strong acids. Bases are corrosive. Now, obviously, if you're going to put your hand in a bowl of sulfuric acid, the effects are immediate. It starts destroying your cells right away. And that's evident immediately. But, sometimes it's just not so evident. Before I married Delia, I was a teenager. Duh. Anyway, we were at a gas station one time, and they were playing this game about throwing quarters up against the wall. Not me, but the gas station attendant and a couple of my friends, and the one that was the closest to the wall won the other quarters. This little game they played. And one of them had taken battery acid, which is pretty weak sulfuric acid, and he had squirted in my back pocket. And of course, it's not strong enough to hurt my skin, and I wasn't aware of this. It's summertime, right? So anyway, it dried, and about a week later, I look at my jeans, and I'm going to put them on, and I look at the back pocket, and it was a different color than the regular jeans, and I touch it, and it just crumbled. It had eaten all the material. All of a sudden, I had a hole about 6 inches in diameter in the back of my jeans, and I thought, what in the world happened here? Then it dawned on me what had happened. He had put some battery acid in there, and it, through the course of time, it just ate away at the threads, and it just totally destroyed my jeans. Well, of course, they're air-conditioned, but they were no good anymore. But that's how sin is, it just sort of eats away at you very slowly, and all of a sudden one day you wake up and say, hey, what's going on here? So, and a very small amount, can do a lot of damage. Another type of corrosion that occurs, and this is a little more technical, it's when two dissimilar metals lay side by side in the ground, and one is protected. And the protection, let's say, like gas pipe, for example, has a plastic coating around it. If the protection is compromised, what happens? You get an electrical circuit going positive to negative. And one atom at a time goes from one to the other. So one gains in size and the other one loses in size. And we have to be very conscious of this in the gas industry, because what happens is eventually it pits down like a cone right till it starts leaking. And that's called corrosion, another type of corrosion. It's very gradual, one atom at a time, but eventually you have a gas leak and then you've got to deal with it. And that's when these two different types of metals are in a certain type of soil. And here again, you know, one atom at a time, just one little thing at a time, and you're corroded by sin. Next thing you know, you've got a problem, a gas leak, right? But, you know, and of course, once you have a gas leak, you've got to do the repairs. But I found that really interesting, these corrosion leaks were always, you know, like a cone, the bottom of an ice cream cone. That's what they look like. But it was gradual. And, you know, we have to, that's why we cover pipes in the ground. It's not such a big issue now because they use plastic pipe for most services, so, it, you know, the plastic doesn't corrode. But, of course, you can put your shovel through it if you're digging in the backyard. So, I mean, it creates other problems. So, sin can eat away at you spiritually to the point where it compromises your salvation. So you've got to be aware of that corrosive effect of sin, the deceitfulness of sin. Anyway, the fourth point is sin causes erosion of the truth. Now, erosion is not in the Bible either, but you can see its effect on someone who practices sin and is not dealing with it. And we're familiar with water erosion. Like, I was working in the backyard, and we were trying to remove this big stump in the backyard, and the guy's machine wasn't big enough, and we had this huge hole. I mean, it was probably 12 feet across and 7 or 8 feet deep, and he just couldn't pull the stump out. So he says to me, he says, get a hose and hose underneath around the root system, and it'll erode the dirt away, and it'll make it easier and then calming when you do that. So he left, and sure enough, I got my hose out, and I'm hosing and hosing and hosing and hosing away, and I had to cut a few roots with it, and then I got him over, and he pulled it out. But it was so big, I said, I'm not going to haul this thing away. We just threw it back in the hole and buried it, but that's how, you know, we got it. And that was the effect of erosion. And it's amazing. We were in Tucson one time at the feast, and you get a lot of erosion sometimes when there's heavy rains. And it was after the feast, and we were looking at the news, and you could see the banks of the river rising, and there was a house close to the bank. And, of course, you know, the soil was getting eroded. It was right on TV, and all of a sudden you could see it was eating away where the part of the house was sticking over the water. And next thing you know, there goes the house, you know, down the river. It just eroded to the point where it just washed the house away. So the effects of sin are that way too. It just erodes till your whole house collapses. Because Christ gave the example. He said, you know, build your house on a rock because it's solid, and not on sand. Because, you know, sand is great to build a house on. I mean, I had a house in Langley that was built on sand, but it was high, a level area, and you could dig down 100 feet. It was still sand, and it was fine, you know, because it's, you build a house on it, there's no problem. The problem building a house on sand is the location. Now, if you have it where the land slopes towards your house and it's built on sand and the rains come, the water comes and erodes and erodes and erodes, and there goes your house. Sand is very stable. And another issue is if you have a house built on sand over by, you know, by the ocean, it's stable because, I mean, it's not going to go nowhere. It's not going to compress anymore. But an interesting thing happens. A house built on the ocean where the water table is fairly high is if you get an earthquake. And not a big, you know, 9.9 earthquake, but a low-grade earthquake where it just sort of shakes the ground. And you know what happens? The water rises in the sand, and the sand loses its stability after the water saturates it to a certain degree, and then it becomes quicksand. So what happens to your house? It just disappears. It just goes away. So that's why God's saying, don't build your house in the sand, because under certain conditions, you can totally lose it. And when you saturate water with sands, after a while, the sand becomes just like water. It runs like water. It has no more stability. So there's a lesson there about sin. You know, it could erode your life away. It says, I got here, sin can have the same destructive force if you don't make the effort to get rid of it. And over in Revelation 12 and verse 9, let's go over there. Let's see what I wrote down here. All right. This is a deception. You know, it erodes and also deceives you, eh? It's Revelation 12 and verse 9, talking about Satan. It says, so the great dragon was cast out, the serpent of old called the devil, who deceives the whole world, and he was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So it just goes to show that not only does sin erode your thinking, but it, you know, it deceives you too. And of course, we know that the world is deceived. The fifth thing that sin does, it scrambles your thinking. And this is more evident in people who once knew the truth, because people in the world, they're not being called now, and they just don't get it, even if you try to explain to them, you know, the truth. And there is no understanding of spiritual truths in them, and then they're just not being called. But what I've really noticed is the lack of logic and biblical understanding of those who have left the truth. And it's similar to a virus in your computer. You know, at first it may slow your computer down, and then if you don't deal with it, it gets worse, and it can totally corrupt and scramble your computer. It's making it totally unusable. So if you don't deal with it early, you know, you have to deal with the computer. You have to get rid of it. And you talk to people that have left the truth, and you're left with the feeling that something just isn't quite right with their thinking. I mean, you know, you wonder, where did all that knowledge go? Where did that understanding go? And let's just look at a few examples of this in Exodus 32. Exodus 32, verses 7 and 8, it says, and the Lord said to Moses, get down there, here we go again, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molten calf and worshipped and sacrificed to it. And said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. So here again, it shows that, you know, they were corrupted by sin, and they weren't, you know, thinking straight. And over in Deuteronomy chapter 9, got another reference here in regards to that. In Deuteronomy 9, verses 11 and 12, and it came to pass at the end of 40 days and 40 nights that the Lord gave me the two tablets. This is Moses speaking, of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Then the Lord said to me, go down quickly from here, for your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt have acted corruptly. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them, and they have made themselves a molten image. So we could see that the effect of sin on their activity and their and the things that they did. And I have one more here in the book of Judges. Judges 2. In Judges 2, and I'm going to read verse 16 and 17, and I'll be there in a second. Okay, Judges 2 and verse 16. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them, and they would not listen to them, to their judges, but they played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked, and obeying the commandments of the Lord, they did not do so. So it shows here again how quickly, you know, you could turn from righteousness to sin, and the effect of having your mind scrambled by sin, and it affects your thinking and how you think. The sixth thing that sin does, it distances you from God. If you think of a hose in the sense, and you're trying to get water out, and you have particles in it, resistance, that limits the amount of water you get out. And sin can act like that. It can limit your effectiveness as a Christian because it acts as a resistance, just like rust in a pipe or, you know, narrowing the arteries causes high blood pressure, right? Because it's a closed system. And they give you nitroglycerin pills, and what that does, it expands your blood vessels, and of course your blood pressure drops. So there's a relationship between pressure, length of hose, and size of pipe. So if you have a 100-foot hose and you're getting 10 gallons out, if you go at the 50-foot and cut the hose there, you'll get more water out. If you go to the tap, you'll get way more water. Or, you know, you're hosing beside your neighbor and he's got a half-inch hose and you've got a 3/4-inch hose and they're both the same length, you'll get more water out than him. Or else, if you go and adjust your regulator and increase the pressure, you'll get more water out that way. So there's a relationship between pressure and size and distance. And it's the same thing with your relationship with God. I mean, the closer you are to God, the more effective you're going to be, the more of God's Spirit can flow out of you, if you think of the water as God's Spirit. And the further away you are, well, the less effective you are and the less water is going to come out. So, I mean, there's a relationship. So sin acts as a resistance. It's like drives you further away. It creates problems with, you know, resistance within the pipe, so you're not as effective as a Christian and you're not showing the fruits of the Spirit that you should. You know, I've talked to people that have left the church and you wonder, where did all the knowledge go? I mean, you know, and fast too. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, they could spend 30 years in the church and then, you know, a month later they couldn't tell you why you should keep the Sabbath. I mean, where did that go? I mean, that's just the effect of sin on you. It's just unbelievable. Let's look at the book of James. James 4. It gives us some really good admonition here as, you know, to nullify the effects of what sin can do to you about distancing you from God. In James 4 and verse 7, it says, "Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." So you can resist the devil and temptation, and he will flee from you, leave you alone. But it's an effort on your part. And here again, draw near to God, get closer to God, and he will draw near to you. So it has a dual effect. The closer you want to get to God, the closer he wants to get to you. It's like your own child. If your child is so distant, and you know, you don't have an urge to reach out to him. But when your child is loving and he wants to, you know, wants to get close to you, then you have a desire internally to get closer to your child. Well, God's the same way. We're hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. And the time to do that is during the days of unleavened bread. We examine ourselves, put sin out, put righteousness in, get closer to God. And that's the time of the year that, you know, God has given us to do that. Because he knows that because we're human, in time you forget things and you get slack. And you have to have these periods of time where you pull yourself together type of approach and get your act together. So we have to resist the devil, and sin is harmful, and it drives you further from God and makes it more difficult, you know, to commit to God if you're in a state of sin and you're not dealing with it. And my last point, my seventh point is sin will spread if not dealt with. And this principle here is one that we're all familiar with. And it's Paul mentions it in the book of Corinthians, in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. First Corinthians 5 and verse 6, Paul is saying, your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Now, what they were glorying in and not dealing with is this sin that they had amongst, well, what that one individual was having relationship with his mother. And they were proud of it. And you know, they were puffed up about it. And he says, your glorying about this is not good. He says, don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? It doesn't take much. A little leaven. Therefore, purge out the old leaven, get rid of it, that you may be a new lump, since you are truly unleavened. For indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. So a little leaven, if not dealt with, will grow. You've got to get rid of it. And here's a principle to remember over in Proverbs, in regards to this, over in Proverbs 26. And I've seen this in real life. It's amazing the little gems, you know, that God gives us in His Word. Jesus, I mean, it's so plain. I mean, you know, here again with a fire, you need fuel, you need oxygen, and you need heat. Otherwise, you have no fire, and that's why, you know, these fire extinguishers lower the kindling point of the flame, and the fire goes out. But He says, where there is no talebearer, strife ceases. Now, some people are just contentious, you know, and they create problems at work, you know, and they're called what, you know, they're referred to as the bad apple. And they just stir up trouble with employees, and there's always problems with these individuals there. You know, we had one at where I worked, and the guy was a pain in the lower extremities, if you know what I mean. And, of course, these guys, you know, they have union protection, so they get away with murder. And people would complain, and we'd say, well, you know, he'll either move on or retire, but we had to wait till he retires. And, you know, after he retired, it was like a calm fell over the whole shop. I mean, it was just like a whole different atmosphere because the bad apple was gone. I mean, you know, and it's the same thing with a barrel. I mean, you have one bad apple on top. The good apples are not going to make the bad apple, you know, better. What's going to happen eventually through time, it'll rot the whole barrel. So that's why you've got to deal with the bad apple, and if you're the bad apple, you've got to deal with yourself. You don't want, you know, to corrupt others around you. And that's what sin does. And, you know, God is a very practical God, and He gives us these examples so that we can get the concept, you know, like a little leaven leavens the whole lump. I mean, you've got a big barrel full of, you know, dough, and you put a little leavening in it, and come back a week later, it's all leavened. I mean, that is the effect of sins. And we have to keep those things in mind. It's slow but consistent, and it never fails. You know, like, there's no, in other words, you can't tolerate it. You can't say, well, I've got a little sin, but it's not going to affect me. Oh, I'll be okay. That doesn't work that way. If you don't deal with it, it's going to deal with you. And do you think that Satan, you know, like I mentioned earlier, started by, you know, open rebellion right away? No, it was a slow process, you know. Oh, you know, I can do things better, or whatever he used, the reasoning, you know, and eventually turned the whole thing around. And let's go over to Revelation 12 and read a little bit about this in Revelation 12. In verse 1, I'll read verse 1 to 4. It says, now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. And his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour the child as soon as it was born. So here we see, you know, that example of Satan affecting a third of the angels, you know, into rebellion. And, of course, that didn't happen overnight. It was a process, and just like leaven, leaven's a whole lump, and it's a slow. And the thing is, too, it's not only slow, but it's quiet. You know, it doesn't make a lot of noise. You know, an apple in the barrel is quietly doing its job of rottening all the other apples. I mean, you know, if it was making all kinds of noise and whistles, you'd deal with it. But that's the thing about sin, you know. It's quietly eating away at you. Hey, what's that? Well, today I have given you the definition of what sin is and what sin does to you and the negative effects it has on you. And we've looked at the fact that sin deceives, sin corrupts, sin corrodes, sin erodes. Sin scrambles your thoughts. Sin distances, puts distance between you and God. And sin spreads if it's not dealt with. So we have in front of us 6 more days to ponder and deal with any sins that we may be harboring. You know, we have another 6 days during the days of unleavened bread. By giving us the 7 days of unleavened bread, we have both the time and we can get the help to complete the tasks from God, obviously, to put sin out of our lives, and not just put sin out, but to keep it out. That's the key. I don't think God is... It's not a big issue in the sense that we use sin, because we all sin. We just have to deal with it. We can't be practicing sins. We can't let it, you know, sit there dormant, working on us, you know, eating us away. God shows us by the 7 days that it's a task to accomplish, but it also shows that it can be accomplished. And he gives us 7 days to do it, to get the job totally done. So, brethren, let's take advantage of these days and to put sin out, and not only to put it out, but to keep it out and draw close to God during this time of the year.